Good morning. You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting Network. RepublicBroadcasting.org is the URL. And this is Sophia, your host. I'm back on Friday to expand my own mind. That's the purpose of this show. Our world is contracting, it seems, and we have to create expansion within ourselves. The more we learn about what's going on, the more dire and small our possibilities seem to become. Yet, somehow, we have to get beyond this. And I can't tell you the formula. I've had a lot of people email me saying, you never talk about solutions. You just talk about these grandiose kind of new age musts, imperatives, yet you don't tell people how to do it. And I could never explain how to do it. It's something that we have to figure out. It's like a personal journey. And I'll tell you what has started to happen now. This movement, the 9/11 movement, in which I was included by virtue of the fact that I made the film 9/11 Mysteries, has started to fragment. And in some ways that seems organic because it seems like diversity, sort of biological diversity happening in this midst of information gathering. People come up with their own views and they start a website or a group and others disagree with them and there seems to be strong division. People say, no, it could only be this way. It cannot be that way. And very strong enmities are caused. I myself have been the recipient now of the label COINTELPRO and disinformation agent. And this label is coming at me from all sides. In the beginning, I was a bit surprised, and at times, you know, it hurts to be called that. It seems like it is the top insult you can launch at anyone in the 9/11 movement, and possibly in other movements, to call them a COINTELPRO agent. I remember when I was a little child, my brother and I thought the worst thing you could call anybody alive was a bloody fool. We knew what a fool was. It was humiliating to be a fool, and to be called a bloody fool, we could only imagine the sight of a bloody fool, blood all over the place. It was terrifying, and when we got angry at each other, one would just draw their breath and launch this expletive at the other. We would say, you bloody fool. The other one would run crying to our mother, telling her what had just happened. So somehow that has equated, the bloody fool has become the COINTELPRO agent in my own life, and I'm receiving this horrible insult. But anyway, I have as my guest today someone who has also been the recipient of a lot of defamation, and his name you will learn on the other side of the break. You're listening to Expansion with Sophia on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN network. I just finished giving a long introduction and never told you the name of my guest today, which is no other than Jim Fetzer, Professor Jim Fetzer. Are you there, Jim?
Oh, I am, Sophia, and of course, I'm on all those lists you're on. In fact, probably a few more.
Oh, I think you're definitely on more, Jim. I think you're hated a lot more than I am. You could possibly also be a bloody fool.
It's just incredible what has become of this movement, such as it may have been.
Well, you know, I think that everyone, or a lot of people have good intentions, and some cloud their intentions with difficult personalities, even. I was told a long time ago that people in the conspiracy camps are people who are able to see what's wrong with the world, and generally that's because you aren't part of the mainstream. You can see through a lot because you've been given the short end of the stick in your own life experience, or you just have a kind of intelligence or personality that can question and this is, in some ways, I could even call it a rogue personality. Do you know what I mean by that? And I was always different. I was never really part of the in crowd growing up. And I guess my own life struggles enabled me to see this without any real problem. But I think, though, there are deliberate plants, there would have to be, in the camps who stir up trouble and controversy and particularly argument, which creates division, which stops people from working with one another and makes the rhythm, stops the organic rhythm of this. Although somehow it seems to me that the rhythm will continue no matter what happens, you know. I know maybe I'm just repeating myself. So would you...
No, I think that, you know, the perps, those who perpetrated these foul deeds on 9/11, had to have given a great deal of thought to managing, you know, any inquiries into what had actually happened. And it was fascinating to me, you know, when I founded Scholars in December 2005, that there had been basically a flat line in relation to articles related to 9/11. And that after the founding of Scholars, it was a steady upward trend. I think that it had to do with bringing together of experts where you had a society that could represent them and present their findings and so forth and issue press releases and so forth, including several early press releases that I think made a very positive impact in general. But that the more successful we became, and 2006 was really quite a spectacular year where we had an early June conference in Chicago that had 500 attendees, and then, of course, at the end of June, we had the American Scholars Conference where Alex Jones moderated, and C-SPAN, of course, did the panel discussion, which had four members of Scholars, Steve Jones and Bob Bowman and Webster Tarpley and myself, and they taped the hour and 45 and then ran it seven or eight times in good time slots, and I think that actually had the effect of shattering the kind of glass ceiling that had been imposed on public discussion of 9/11. And things went very, very well, I think, right up until, the 11th of November, as I recall, was the date when I had Judy Wood on a show. It was actually the last show I did for Public, Sophia, when I had that program. And we talked about her research in relation to the devastation of the World Trade Center, the toasted cars, all this stuff, the dustification of the towers. It's really sensational because it so broadened the base evidence that had to explain. That's one of the most difficult tasks in science, is getting really clear on everything you have to explain, the other being to consider the full range of alternative hypotheses. And she would suggest the idea that some kind of high-tech or directed energy weapon might have been involved, and I was just, you know, pushing her where it might have been located or situated, and she suggested in space, and I was really, you know, stunned because that was a possibility that hadn't even crossed my mind. It turns out, of course, there are whole families of these weapons. They can be ground-based, space-based, they can be airborne, they could be in dirigibles, and as Bob Bowman would eventually acknowledge, the former director of the Star Wars program, the whole development of the strategic initiative in relation to space was always offensive. It was never defensive, even though it was marketed, sold to the American people as though it were some kind of defensive system. And we now find, although you could have discovered it, dug into it many years ago, because there's even, for example, a professional society for directed energy that has had like 10 annual meetings, and they talk about all the types of weapons they are considering, discussing in various stages of development, their strengths and weaknesses and so forth. But that, when Bo made that confirmation, you know, it seemed to me tremendously important. However, that one, for about a year or more after this particular conversation with Judy, when I, the following 2 days, gave lectures in Tucson, Arizona, where I was at the time, I started to explain, you know, Judy's hypothesis and to suggest maybe they had been located in Building 7, which might explain why Building 7 would be late in being brought down, would be brought down by a different method than the Twin Towers and so forth, because the actual source of the directed energy was there, because the building was erected over two enormous electrical generators. That seemed to me also to be a very plausible reason why it might be in Building 7. But there was a lot of negative reaction almost immediately to any discussion of this possibility, which I thought was incredibly unscientific, given that as I have observed, you know, one of the two most difficult stages of science is making clear, you know, the full range of alternative possible explanations. A huge division in science would then develop with Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, and other members of what I would describe as a clear, determined that this was too much for them to handle, and split off to create what they would then call Scholars for Truth and Justice, which I thought was a very curious choice of term. But anyway,
I'm going to interrupt you. I attempted a year or two ago to convince someone I had not really a friendship with, but I'd seen him for years. He was a surfer, not a stupid guy by any means, and not a young kid. I mean, he was in his 40s, perhaps 50. I gave him a 9/11 DVD. It wasn't 9/11 Mysteries. It was something else, and it was before 9/11 Mysteries came out, my own DVD. And he watched it, and I ran into him a few weeks later and asked him what he thought. And he said, no. He said, I don't think any of that could be the bull. And so I asked him, well, how does a building come down in 10 seconds that's that big and made of that much concrete and steel? And I hurled a couple of questions like that at him. And what he said to me, he said, this is how I view the world. If you see hoof prints, think horse, not unicorns. So,
well, the trouble is that you can't explain the evidence on the hypothesis he's will accept.
Exactly. What's happened is, in our movement, any time a unicorn is introduced, it's rejected, because this is what expanded thinking is all about.
The problem is we don't just have hoof prints, we have horn prints, too.
Well, yes. Okay.
You're not going to be able to explain it just into a horse.
Yes, but the conventional wisdom is to think horses, not unicorns.
But, of course, the conventional wisdom presumably would have it that these 19 Islamic hijackers took over these four commercial airliners and crashed them into these buildings.
Right. It's the same formula. It's the same formula that is showing up. Each time the discussion extends, there is a certain amount of rejection.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
In a way you have to forgive those who are rejecting, because they're part of this, the reality, the organic nature of the expansion.
Yeah.
So
well, the problem is that if the scientific scruples were preserved by all parties to these discussions, or non-discussions as the case may be, if they were equal open to new evidence and the impact of that evidence on the hypotheses, then we might, you know, be able to say that what we have is a common phenomenon in the history of science, namely the emergence of competing research programs, and they often, you know, compete for base reasons such as a desire in a product, the Nobel, or for, you know, greater glory, awards, tenure, or other kinds of distinction. In that habit, for example, in the development of the DNA hypothesis, the double helix. So you have James Watson giving a brilliant description of how he and Crick were part of one program, and others were in competition with them, and how, you know, very subjective personal motives affected their research. It was a book that was widely condemned by many scientists who want the public to believe the science is all neat and tidy in the form of the finished science research project that's published in a journal. But, of course, that's far from the reality of the nuts and bolts of science. The problem became that there was a new orthodoxy within 9/11. Basically, the Jones group clustering around the thermite-thermate hypothesis, which I never felt could adequately explain all the evidence, certainly not after I was exposed to Judy's stunning work about the scope and extent of the evidence, which is still available, of course, on drjudywood.com. And I began featuring a guest on the show, and a new show I had on GCN, and I must have had her on 15, 20, maybe 30 times. I don't know. A lot of those shows are linked from Judy's website.
Well, we're going off for our break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. You're listening to Expansion with Sophia on republicbroadcasting.org, IBN Network. My guest is Jim Fetzer, who founded the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group and has since been sort of excommunicated from the 9/11 movement due to his introduction of the material of Dr. Judy Wood. This material was sort of an experiment. expanded view, I'll use the name of my own show, of the 9/11 Twin Tower destruction hypothesis, and it was roundly rejected by a lot of people within the movement who preferred to stick with the keep it simple theory that let's just explain to the public that this controls us, and let's not bring in more advanced technologies that they have no knowledge of and won't be able to understand. And Jim, you were telling us about the number of times you had interviewed Judy Wood, and you gave great that you gave her this platform from which to speak. Now, however, what is happening with that relationship? This is what I kind of want to get into. That the whole thing keeps fragmenting on itself.
Well, you're absolutely right, Sophia. But let me add just a couple of words about the split with Steve, because I think they're really crucial to lay a background for the further developments with Judy, which is that I was dismayed with them because they seemed to be putting politics ahead of science. In other words, they were more concerned with what the public impression might be. Judy had used the word space beam or in one of her titles, or beam, energy beam, or something of that sort. And I knew as soon as I heard it that it was going to be used against her, and, of course, against me if I was, in fact, supporting her, as I continued to do. But the fact is that there have been, real questions about the approach, the adequacy of the approach revolving around thermite, the horse versus the unicorn, the simpler hypothesis, some of which, for example, I brought up at Chandler, who and I first met, namely that the some of the photographs that are used to support the hypothesis of massive pools of molten metal are faked or phony, and it's not difficult to determine that that's the case on a number of general principles.
Well, I have to cut in there. Now, I don't want this to be a discussion of 9/11 evidence, but I would to say this, that I did speak to a rescue worker, and I mentioned this to you, and I mentioned it to Judy Wood and a number of other people, who did confirm. Actually, I didn't ask him. He brought it up. He was a very experienced firefighter. He was there for weeks at Ground Zero cleaning up. And he did say that there were large areas that spewed what looked like red-hot debris, and you could see molten metal in coming out as equipment was pulling things from those pits. One, he said, was the size of a football field, and it lay directly between where the two towers had stood. However, what I want to point out here is, again, it's the concept of unicorns. He never mentioned heat. None of those rescue workers, this is one of the things Judy points out, that the dog's feet are not burning. People are not talking about heat. And if you were there and there was that much molten metal and rivers, whatever, running underground, so this tends to cause people to say, well, there couldn't have been any molten metal. It must all be made up. However, there could have been metal in liquid state that hadn't gotten that way by way of heat, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be metal flowing that was liquid, but it wasn't hot. This red-hot stuff that was spewing, we're just using terms that live within our own experience. Something that's red and fiery looking, we assume we call it red hot, but what if it isn't hot?
Right, because there's a lot of rapid oxidation going on where the iron, the steel rather, was becoming rust-colored almost overnight, which was fairly remarkable. And, of course, massive quantities, an estimated 11 million gallons of water were dumped on the site, and if there were large pools of molten metal, it would have enormous steam explosions, which, of course, did not occur.
Right, so we have to concede that the metal was liquid, but it wasn't hot. And that's what I want to explore. That takes an expanded understanding, if it's true. So I want to find someone who can explain how that happened.
Well, here's another consideration, too. I mean, a paper in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which Steve edits and co-edits with Kevin Rand, who among the authors, talks about the enormously high temperatures that were produced at World Trade. Of course, the melting point of steel is around 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. But that seems to me to be contradicted by the fact that there were tons and tons of paper that were not turned into very fine dust by whatever process.
Okay, but I'm not here, Jim, I'm not to take apart Steam Jones' theories.
Sophia, I know that. Yeah. I'm just making a point here at the end that you'll appreciate.
Okay.
The melting, the paper burns at 450 degrees Fahrenheit, as Ray Bradbury reminded us in his book, Fahrenheit 451.
Yes.
So if there actually were these massively high temperatures, you know, extremely high temperatures, should have burned. Now, the point I'm making is the politics is overriding the science, and that the orthodoxy is being allowed to dictate what's considered and what isn't, even when it comes to evidence. So that, you know, this is a part and parcel of managing research within 9/11, and in my it's very unscientific, but it has to be politically motivated, since there's no other explanation. Partially, I think, but on the false belief that the public can't handle the truth.
Yeah, I understand that. That was actually a good point that you made. So Fahrenheit 451. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. This is our break music. We'll be back. You're listening to Expansion with Sophia on Republic Broadcasting Network. Publicbroadcasting.org is the URL. My guest today is Setzer, Professor Jim Setzer, who started the Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and that group has divided, and other groups in the 9/11 that have divided, and some of this is due to rabble-rousing and, I guess, enmity that's being created between people, deliberately being created. And I am going to up the Ace Baker site, on which Ace Baker has posted a definition of disinformation, which is interesting, and I think we'll have Ace Baker explain this himself. Ace, are you on the line?
I'm here, Sophia. It's good to talk to you.
Yes, welcome to my little show. Ace, would you like to tell us a little bit about why you put up a definition, and then perhaps read a definition or read it? And you might want to also introduce yourself to the audience.
Well, my name's Ace Baker. I'm a music composer and producer. I'm also an expert in visual effects. I've been researching 9/11 for several years now. I spoke at Professor Fetzer's Madison conference just about a year ago. I have done quite a bit of work looking at the fake airplane videos that were shown by the news media on 9/11, and in particular I've shown that the airplanes cannot possibly be real, that there are any number of ways to prove that they are in fact video composites, that they are real footage, except for they've had a computer-drawn airplane inserted into them.
Sophia, just to interject ever so briefly, I mean, among the areas of research that have become excluded and condemned by the orthodoxy are not only research on the possibility that lasers, masers, plasmoids, some kind of unconventional weaponry may have been used to destroy the Twin Towers, but any studies of the possibility of video fakery in relation to the videos that show planes hitting the Twin Towers, or even the possibility that maybe there were no planes, even though there's a massive amount of indirect evidence to support that hypothesis, at least with regard to the alleged commercial carriers, the 767s and 757s that were supposed to be involved, where 9/11 Blogger has taken a leading role in excluding people who, for example, just off of one illustration, had anything to do with the Madison conference. Not only because Ace was speaking about video fakery or no planes, so Morgan Reynolds, and of course, of all sins, Judy Wood was there presenting her research in great detail and abundance. So anyone who had anything to do with the Madison conference has been blackballed, banned from even from Blogger, where discussion of the most controversial issues ought to be taking place, but is not, because of a very heavily called censorship and exclusion operation.
Yes. Well, I want to read Ace's definition that he's put up here, because I find it interesting. The purpose of disinformation is to deceive. Large-scale government media, you have govern-media.
That's the word I coined, govern media. Go ahead.
Govern media operations require obedience and extensive policy objectives, typically run contrary to the interest of most people. Now, what I find interesting. Broadly speaking, disinformation can take one of two forms: trying to get the public to believe something which is actually false, and trying the public to disbelieve something which is actually true. So they want you to either believe something that's true, not to believe something that's true. I guess those two coexist, don't they?
Right.
Okay.
Certainly with 9/11, both all of that's going on.
Well, I find there are so many layers to 9/11. There are horses running with, did you hear my horse's unicorn example?
I did not. I'm sorry. Was that earlier?
Someone said to me a few months ago who does not believe that 9/11 was anything but what the media had told us. He said, if you see hoof prints, think horses, not unicorns. In other words, if a building falls in 10 seconds, you've got to think pancake collapse. That's the horse. Anything else is the unicorn. And within the 9/11 discussion of all possible explanations, there is rejection of those explanations that come across as unicorns. So the video fakery would be a unicorn, the no planes would be a unicorn, directed energy would be a unicorn, nukes is a unicorn. And these things are being shunted aside in the effort to create a sort of homogeneous, simple picture that Joe Public can swallow. If
right,
bring
I think
them around.
The metaphor actually a good one. If you see hoof prints, think horses, not unicorns. But the interpretation is exactly upside down and backwards. We see airplane videos that look fake. For instance, in the CNN ghost plane video, we have a frame where the wing of the airplane has passed beyond the wall of the tower, and yet no damage visible to the wall. It looks like a fake video that we know has been standard practice in TV and film to make all kinds of different video composites for a long time. That's the horror. The notion that an aluminum airplane can just glide through a steel and concrete tower effortlessly without slowing, bending, twisting, or exploding, that's the unicorn. Similarly, we see two of the tallest buildings and biggest buildings in the world exploding into powder horizontally and pushing up a mushroom cloud. The normal explanation for that observation would be that they were blown up somehow. And so that's the horror, and the notion that they fell down and but that somehow all of the floor assemblies disappeared, that's the unicorn.
Mm-hmm. Now you have here A, acceptance of a false narrative. Number one, divide the false narrative into component pieces, then repackage each element surrounded by true but irrelevant details. Can you give an example of that?
The NIST report, the idea is to, you've got this false story that, 19 hijackers, four planes, building collapses, et cetera. First take the story apart into lots of little pieces and then surround all those false pieces with true but irrelevant stuff. And although I have huge problems with Jim Hoffman, one thing that he did an excellent job of is deconstructing the original NIST report, and Hoffman called it a mountain of irrelevant details. And they go into all this excruciating detail on the structure of a 767 and these really elaborate computer fire models and just all this stuff. And then, of course, 10,000 pages, and they don't even study what happens after these buildings begin.
Yeah, I love this. Let me mention a historical illustration of this in relation to the Warren Commission report and its supporting volumes. It had extensive reports about the dental done of Oswald's mother, which Mark Lane pointed out would be completely irrelevant even if Oswald had gummed the president to death. I mean, it's a pattern that's been pursued in many contexts, right? And it's very clearly stated in your formulation.
Right. And number two, under A, acceptance of a false narrative. If falsehood is presented by a seemingly credible source, for instance, expert. So that would be NIST itself, right?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we're the experts. You
right.
You know.
And number three, public swallows the false story piece by piece.
Right.
So,
you know, what's it's more pleasant. It's a sugar-coated pill, and as disturbing as the official story of 9/11 is, it's a lot more palatable than the truth.
Okay, so number B, rejection of a true narrative. One, divide the truth into component pieces, then repackage each element surrounded by false details. The false details range from plausible to absurd. All right, so Let's hear your example, maybe, of that.
Oh, God. And again, so this is the same idea, but flipped upside down, trying to get people to not believe the truth. Somewhere out there, there's the truth about 9/11, what actually happened. An example might be John Lear. John Lear has done some great work. He's a pilot, and he's done some excellent, created some excellent material on explaining why 767 aircraft cannot fly over 500 miles an hour at low altitude. But he's also pushing the idea that there are holograms of airplanes, which is actually impossible. You cannot project a hologram up into thin air. And he's also pushing the notion, unrelated to 9/11, but he's that there's millions of people living on the far side of the moon. So what I see in John Lear is, again, packaging the truth about the plane crashes at the WTC with this other false and absurd things, so that reasonable people will encounter the whole package and throw all of that away, including the true part. And so piece by piece, they take the truth, package it with false and absurd things so that reasonable people come along and throw the whole thing down the toilet.
Well, the NIST report on buildings probably works in this category, too. I mean, it was clearly a controlled demolition, but they want to, you know, introduce all kinds of points about diesel tanks, for example, being distributed in buildings, which was true, ignoring that diesel is non-explosive and has a very low burning point, claiming these fires, you know, were burning at great length. Well, they could have burned all day long, just like that jet fuel could have been massive in quantity, but it's not going to burn hotter than it can burn, which in the case of jet fuel is a max of 1,800 degrees, way below what is required to cause steel to melt. And in the case of both buildings, in fact, NIST reported after studying 236 samples of steel in the towers that 233 had not been exposed to temperature 500 degrees, which is the typical temperature of an officer. So no matter how many, 500-degree fires there might have been in Building 7, and there actually appear to have been relatively modest, limited fires in that building, they couldn't possibly have caused building to collapse in the fashion that we can observe that the NIST claims was all caused purely by fire, the first and only time in world history.
Now, by the way, someone told me yesterday that NIST is promoting its report under the headline or title, 9/11 Mysteries Solved.
Quite absurd.
Now, do you understand? That's the use of
title.
Mysteries DVD, so it creates an association.
Mm-hmm.
In the mind of the Joe public, mainstream, that, okay, so 9/11 mysteries are solved, there are no mysteries, et cetera, et cetera. Now, number two under your letter B, ACE, is repackaged truth is presented by a lunatic.
Right. If possible. So, for instance, again, John Lear, he's not, I maybe should add that, a perceived lunatic. John Lear is not a lunatic at all. He is a perfectly sane, very intelligent man. But when people, especially from, say, outside the truth movement who want to learn more and come to this fresh, learn that John Lear claims that there are millions of people living on the far side of the moon, they will reject him as a lunatic.
I hold John Lear in high esteem for his brilliance in relation to planes and flight and all that, and I frankly don't know what to make of some of his other views, which are rather extraordinary.
Right. Well, that's how I reconcile it. Stephen Jones, a very brilliant nuclear physicist. And very sober, methodical, and very non-offensive in his entire presentation and manner. Yet, from what I understand, he's written papers that, and this would have to do with his religious affiliations, that Jesus Christ came to America in the 1800s and things like that. So it appears to be like a fail-safe out point if they ever need to take Jones out. They can go with something, an angle like this, and portray him as a nutcase.
Yeah, what's remarkable about
Jones Hood? has done unquestionably a fantastic job of actually presenting the visual evidence of what happened at 9/11, but then she comes along and associates the whole thing with the Hutchison effect. There is no Hutchison effect. John Hutchison is a video faker from way back. He makes upside-down videos. And so reasonable people will come encounter all of this fantastic visual information Judy has amassed and then wrap it all together with the Hutchison effect as a lunatic and throw it away. So it's a great way to get people to take the truth and throw it away.
Who engineers the association? Are they just organic? Is there somebody saying, Judy Wood, you get together now with Hutchison and we'll present both of you?
Ah, great question.
You know, I mean, that's what I want to know. Because
I can't, you know, we could entertain the possibility that Judy really believes in the Hutchison effect, but in order to test that idea, I played a little trick, and I designed a test. And what I did back in January is I announced to the group that would, and you have your audience should know that I was very close in the inner circle with Judy Wood and Morgan Rhodes and their attorney, Jerry Liepart. I not only spoke at the conference with them, but I also had a sleepover three-day interview session at Jerry Liepart's house in Connecticut that included Judy and Morgan and Jerry and executive producer Stephen Goodale and others. And so I was in very trusted with these people, but I announced to them that I had bought a telecoil and some equipment and I was going to attempt to reproduce the Hutchison. Then I made videos the same way John Hutchison does and showed things falling upwards. And I said, no, I have reproduced the Hutchison effect. Now, if Judy Wood really believed the Hutchison effect was real, she would have been overcome with curiosity and excitement. And, oh, how did you do it? What, you know, what voltages did you use? What, where was this? Well, you know, do we have more? Can I see it? Blah, blah, blah. And none of those people said a word. I waited day after day after day. I spent more
emails. We are going into our break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. We're going to Expansion on RBN, republicbroadcasting.org, and I am your host, Sophia. I am speaking with Professor Jim Fetzer, who founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and Ace Baker, who is the developing. Are you making a film, Ace?
Yes, I am. I'm making a DVD. It's called 9/11, The Great American Psy Opera. The story of the evidence, first of all, and promised as a solution to 9/11, which includes, first and foremost, the fact that there were no plane crashes at the World Trade Center, which really solves 9/11 because plane crashes prove media complicity. It proves demolition. If there's no planes, the entire collapse story disappears with nothing else. And it's the story of the cover up and the disinformation and how the entire thing was a psychological operation first and foremost, that it was designed to scare people.
I agree with you that it had to be a psychological operation, which is ongoing. It's a massive drama. But I'm going to pose this question to you, and I hope you take it well. I'm going to look at both A and B of your two choices here in your disinfo formula. So, A, I'm going to reject. False narrative is presented seemingly credible source expert with you, because you aren't the mainstream credible source expert. They never heard of you before, right?
Right.
I'm going to look at number two, or B, rejection of a true narrative. And I'm going to ask you, why are we supposed to exclude you from the application of your formula? So I'll just read this. Rejection of a true narrative. So divide the truth into component pieces, then repackage elements surrounded by false details. The false details range from plausible to absurd. Now, Joe Public is going to have a very hard time thinking that just on the piece of things, okay, that those videos were faked.
Right, and well, I would hope that after seeing the film, they will consider the facts and the evidence. When people see that frame of video where the wing is already past the wall of the tower, and there's no damage to the tower, reasonable people must conclude that it's a fake video.
But we're going to have to get those people to sit and watch your film. And on the face of it, your theory, I'll just call it a theory for now, is going to be, I think, even more severely rejected than the possibility that 9/11 was a controlled demolition and planes did strike, but jet fuel didn't cause the collapse, something else. The sort of division, the magician trick of here's one event and this causes the second event. I think that your film may be brilliant, but somehow in order to get the mainstream to watch it, people have to be more open-minded than they've ever been. You know what I mean?
No, they won't. I mean, the sad part is that people support 9/11. Now, there's a big difference between believing the official story, which no thinking person does even today, and supporting the official story. And the truth is that a lot of people like the endless war, and a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, feel that they personally benefit from the endless war, and they understand that they need 9/11 to support the global domination project. And there was a lot of people that were all gung-ho for kicking ass on the Middle East long before 9/11, and 9/11 was just this great excuse. And while outwardly people would say, oh, that's terrible, inwardly, I'm sorry to say, I think a lot of people were secretly overjoyed.
Men, are you urinating more freely?
You're listening to Expansion on Republic Broadcasting Network. RepublicBroadcasting.org is the URL. And we're here with Jim Fetzer and Ace Baker. I believe he's still on the line. Are you there, Ace? Maybe not. All right. Well, my guest today is Jim Fetzer. Are you there, Jim? I don't hear anyone. Let's try to get Jim Fetzer back on the line. But anyway, we were just discussing the rejection of the true narrative, and I lost contact with Ace Baker, but his definition or analysis or formula, rather, of disinformation can be found at www.acebaker.blogspot.com. I do hear... are we back on the line with Jim Fetzer?
Yes, I'm back.
Hi, Jim. So anyway, I think Ace has hung up.
Okay.
Yes, and I was going to restate his... I think Ace might want to edit this letter B here that he has, rejection of a true narrative, and number two under letter B is repackaged truth as presented by a lunatic. I think that should say perceived lunatic.
Yeah.
But at any rate, it seems to me that this issue of video fakery is going to be a very hard one to sell to a lot of people, simply because there were so many films shot or videos taken of the plane from so many different angles.
Yeah, you think there were so many, but the fact is you can prove video fakery if you can find any of them that are faked. And in fact...
Well, sure, yes, that there was something altered if in any one of them is enough to say that why was this on TV if it was altered?
Right.
Yeah, and that's a big dent.
It's the difference between the logic of verification, showing something is true conclusively, and falsification, showing something is false conclusively. You can falsify the hypothesis all rabbits are white by finding one brown rabbit. You can't prove that all rabbits are white, however, by making any finite number of observations, because there always could be space-time points you haven't examined where there's a rabbit that's a non-white thing. So people just don't understand some of the most basic elements about reasoning here. Now, the thing about Ace and the video fakery, and the point you're leading to, I think, is also this, namely, as I have very frequently observed, video fakery... If the videos are authentic, then there had to be planes. But if the videos are fake, then they could have been faked in order to conceal features of the planes or their interaction with the building that might have given away what was going on. So that video fakery is actually compatible with planes or with no planes. And therefore, to resolve that, I think you have to resort to a broader evidential base. For example, that as Colonel George Nelson has observed, there are thousands of uniquely identifiable parts on each of these aircraft, and yet not one of them has ever been produced from any of the four alleged crash sites. Or that, as John Lear has observed, there's an envelope that the captain must submit to the airline when a plane pulls away from a terminal that includes, you know, the passenger manifest, the certification the plane is airworthy and all that. None of those envelopes has ever been produced. Not only that, but some of the purported evidence that's supposed to prove plane crashes turns out to have been planted. For example, there's an engine on Church and Murray Street that is not only from the wrong kind of plane, a 737, but appears to have been offloaded from a van. And Jack White actually has discovered footage from Fox that shows a van with FBI agents trying to haul out something very heavy. It's set down on the sidewalk, and of course, there's no damage to the sidewalk, which would necessarily have occurred if this very heavy engine had crashed into it at high speed. So,
yes, we are going for another 3-minute break. We'll be back. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm picking up the second hour with Jim Fetzer, my guest, who founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Back in, I think it was 2005?
December 2005, yeah, right at the end of the year.
Yeah, and I remember how excited people were when the group was formed, Jim, and people felt, okay, here are professionals and rather academic people with real credentials, just the way that people have become excited at the formation of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. These members of this group are professionals, credentialed with experience of buildings and so forth.
Oh, sure.
And so that has gave people a lot of hope when Scholars was formed. And then, fortunately, the Scholars group divided. But I don't think division is necessarily a bad thing. I think that it creates more platforms on which people can have discussions.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and I think that the proliferation of these different, more specialized groups is a very, very good thing. You know, I have the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. You got the Pilots for 9/11 Truth. And, of course, if you go on to Patriots Question 9/11, which is an extraordinarily important, maybe the single most important 9/11 site in relation to interacting with the public, you got over 1,100 experts in different fields, over 140 military intelligence service, law enforcement, government officials, 520 engineers and architects, so 120 pilots and aviation professionals, 280 professors, 210 9/11 survivors and family members, 160 artists, entertainers and media professionals, and for each one you got a bio sketch, a photograph, and a statement of why they doubt 9/11, what they've been told by the government.
Let me say something about this. Criticism I have heard, I think that's a great website myself, Patriots for 9/11 Truth, but I've heard criticism that it's not a good website because you'll find people together that, well, you'll find lunatics, let's say, mixed in with non-lunatics. This comes from the Orthodox, the horse's viewpoint in the 9/11 movement. So,
yeah, but that presumes that they have privileged access to the truth, which is wrong. I mean, that's a very arrogant attitude, unless, in fact, you know, who's supposed to be a candidate? I mean, some of those people have run a campaign to try to have me not on that list. Well, what an absurdity. Here I am, a distinguished professor. I've published 28 books. I have over 150 articles. I founded journals and societies and edited libraries of professional books. I mean, if you look at the relative credentials of the scholars on the field, I am comparable with the very strongest. And, you know, for them to attack me because they disagree with my views, because I think we have to investigate directed energy and alternative hypotheses in relation to the Twin Towers. We have to investigate video fakery. We have to consider seriously the possibility that there were no planes. And I was beginning to, you know, enumerate some of the evidence there that goes far beyond the video fakery. But if there were no planes, it'd have to be video fakery. If there were no planes, you'd have to fake evidence. Evidence was faked. Videos do appear to be faked. Evidence has been fabricated, and you don't have all those parts. I mean, what's the probability that it went down the way the government claims with these four planes, and not one of these thousands upon thousands of uniquely identifiable time-sensitive parts has turned up? What's the probability, if the government's account is true, that you're going to have none of these four envelopes? What's the probability that you're going to have the faked engine on Church and Murray? What's the probability you're going to have a fake piece of Northwestern, of an airline 757 fuselage that actually came from a wreck back in Calais, Colombia in 1995 that was planted on the Pentagon lawn? You wouldn't have to plant evidence and fake videos if it were, if the government story were true. Obviously, it's ridiculously false, and they had to fake evidence.
So are you saying that some portion of the 9/11 movement believes in the planted plane evidence?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Believes that it supports the existence of real planes.
Right. So there, we would then be getting into the horses versus the unicorns. You're much too much a unicorn person, you know. That's why you're having this kind of trouble. And the fact that I even have you on my show, and now I've had Ace Baker, God knows what's going to happen to me because of that.
Yeah, well, Sophia, bear in mind, I mean, I'm a professional philosopher. I mean, I'm a student of the philosophy of science. I have a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. I've published many books, many articles on the nature of scientific reasoning. It's not going to be surprising that someone with my professional background who spent 35 years teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, and who also happens to be a former Marine Corps officer, should look at these matters differently and recognize the necessity from the perspective of the theory of science to consider even the alternatives that you don't find psychologically palatable. You have to consider them as a matter of the integrity of science. And that's why I fault these truth and justice people who are putting arbitrary boundaries on the limits of science for the sake of political purposes. It's very unscientific. It's very unprofessional. And for them to arrogantly assume that they have privileged access to the truth is provably not the case. And similarly with Blogger. Now, here you have a group of non-professionals.
Okay, I want to stop you for a minute.
Go.
There are two things going on here. There's limiting what's offered to the public, and then there is saying, no, this couldn't happen at all. For instance, let's just use directed energy as an example.
Sure.
There are those who say, no, no way, and no, no way. It's too much of a unicorn, it's absolutely not possible. And then there are others who say, well, it might be possible, but we don't want to openly discuss that in our presentations to the public because we want the public to come on board as smoothly as possible. And this would create a difficult entry.
Well, I've addressed that question many times in many contexts. I mean, I think that what you want to do as an activist in interacting with the public is emphasize our disproofs of the government's official account. If you go to 9/11 Scholars in the upper left-hand corner on the menu bar, we have Why Doubt 9/11 that gives about two dozen disproofs. You don't have to go into the fact that we're actually also trying to figure out how it happened. You can say that without having to explain that it's a messy, controversial business and people have very different views and nothing is completely resolved yet, which is true, though I think now that the evidence for video fakery has placed the matter beyond a reasonable doubt.
So there's a category here in ACE's formula. I don't think it's part of the formula, but it should be rejection of a false narrative. We want to educate the public to reject the false narrative.
Oh, sure. We want to promote the acceptance of the true and the rejection of the false. Absolutely. And the activists should be working actively on the rejection of the false. That's correct.
That's about the best we can do in a
uniform way. Well, in terms of public interaction, if you think, you know, and this is a function of your background and imagination and so forth. I mean, I presented lectures where I go through and I explain, now here is some of the evidence why some people are suspicious of the videos. And I talk about the planes, you know, traveling too fast, the way the plane enters the building, and the fact that the cutouts aren't there but appear to have been created by explosions after the fact. And now, of course, I would add that the plane's moving in uniform motion both through air and through these steel and concrete structures, which is utterly impossible, but it can be shown in two different, both the Evans Fairbanks and the Hazakani video, that you can see that the plane travels its own length in 10 frames and then travels completely into the building its own length in the same number of frames. Well, that's a physical impossibility given Newton's laws. So, I mean, you know, to me, being a rigorous scientific thinker, Sophia, does not come easily to people. That's why it requires so much training. And even persons who have a strong scientific background may find they are inhibited psychologically from drawing conclusions, even when they're obvious, for political or other reasons. And to me, it's distressing. You have to separate the science from the politics. If you want to market the proof that the official account is false, primarily in the political arena, I think that's fine. But in the scientific arena, we have to go further. If we're committed to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about 9/11, which has always been my vision of what we're about. But now the civilians, let's say, the people who don't have a technical scientific background, like those who run 9/11 Blogger, they have they just don't understand science, or they have an excessively political agenda. And these include people like Reprehensor, John Gold, this person calls herself Colonel Jenny Sparks, Victronics, who is Victoria Ashley, this is Jim Hoffman's girlfriend, who is very prominent with Scholars for Truth and Justice, and who has been particularly nasty in attacking people she doesn't like, from the Orthodox point of view, including Judy Wood, Morgan Reynolds, and me. I mean, it's just been outrageous.
And myself.
And you too. And I'm kind of, I was floored when David Griffin and I had an exchange where David said he was considering withdrawing from Scholars because it had been pointed out that Judy and Morgan had suggested that Steve Jones was a retard based on their sentence when they were trying to explain something to Steve and he was resisting it, that he can't be that retarded. Actually, from a logical point of view, when you say someone can't be that retarded, you're saying they're not retarded. They're saying it's not even possible that they're retarded. And I pointed this out to David Ray Griffin, that they not only were not calling him retarded, they were actually affirming he was not retarded in order to use that as a rhetorical device to emphasize that he really ought to be accepting the obvious evidence and then raising questions about why he was not. And that was a perfectly impeccable logical point. Now, if Griffin were to look at the Victoria Ashley attacks on all of us, I mean, they are quite outrageous, and there are other articles that appear in that Journal of 9/11 Studies, such as one by Eric Salter, where he goes on and on about, attacking the people who are lunatics or clowns. I'm not now giving you exactly the words he used, but they're equivalent to that in his article, and it's outrageous just when he should have an objective paper talking about the evidence.
We are going into our 3-minute break. We'll be back on the other side. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I am speaking today with Dr. Jim Fetzer, who formed Scholars for 9/11 Truth in 2005. Jim, I think that was quite a tirade. I understand there's a lot of emotion around all the slander that's going on, apparent slander between factions in this movement. And I feel that it's very difficult for people to agree on what has to be presented. That seems to be the bottom line here. And it's difficult for people to agree on their different views of things. You have ventured into some territory that other people just don't want to join you in, and they don't think that it's fitting to present this publicly. So,
yeah, which is the politics interfering with science.
Yeah. However, even to use the word science, the public is not scientific. That was one thing that was pointed out to me by somebody else, that the public, they can barely tell you what the boiling point of water is. They can't explain to you what absolute zero is. They can't tell you the melting point of steel or even maybe appreciate some of these fire temperatures. They don't want to know that kind of thing.
You can't understand scientific issues without understanding a modicum of science. I would explain that the fires did not burn hot enough or long enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt.
I understand, but
look, Sophia, what goes on is a characteristic straw man argument. They give an exaggerated version that they say the public won't buy. When I've given lectures where I showed films of the plane, or video photographs of the plane going into the building and say, it doesn't look right, that you ought to have a lot of crumpling, you know, parts of the plane falling off and it just disappears into the building. I've never had one person in an audience where I explain that raise an objection. I've never had one person say when I explain some people suspect that some of the videos that were shown may have been faked to conceal what was actually the true causes of what was taking place. I've never had one person raise an objection. So the idea that the public can't understand this is ridiculous. We underestimate the public. These are people who have their own peculiar views of what is and isn't acceptable. They are people who are authoritarian at heart. They are people who are trying to control the flow of information and the investigation of science. This is completely irresponsible if our objective is to discover the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the
truth. You didn't quite let me finish my original statement. The public wants to know who did it. They want to know the bad people, not the good or bad science.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we're not able to say, we're still lodged in the discovery process. So people are blaming this on some level on the Bush administration, or so it's thought.
Yeah.
It's much bigger than that.
I've been pretty explicit in talking about Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and General Richard Myers and Rudy Giuliani and Larry Silverstein and their friends, including what appears to be a significant contribution from Israel, the by way of the Mossad. And I've said that quite explicitly, for example, in a piece of mine you can find online under the title 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda. And some versions have a lot of links that are supportive of what I have to say there. The version that's on First American Books is a particularly good one, which also happens to be illustrated, unlike any of the others. But the fact of the matter is the evidence points in one direction and one direction only, namely collusion between certain key elements of this administration and what appeared to be a significant contribution from Israelis.
Right, and blamed on the Arabs.
Right? Look, what could be more telling, Sophia, than when in the midst of these buildings, massive flames, and they're about to collapse, and thousands of people have been killed, and they show some footage of Palestinians cheering that turns out to have been dredged out of archives on a holy day when they were celebrating martyrs and all that. It had nothing to do with that. I mean, it raises a question. What do we think? There was a large-screen TV on the Gaza Strip, so the Palestinians could all watch this in real time, and they were out there cheering. They were just as flabbergasted and stunned as anyone else in the world. And this, the fact that that footage was shown is absolutely damning in terms of what the real motivation and what was going on here.
Yeah, but again, as I mentioned before, the public immediately says, who did this? They want to know the bad people, not necessarily the...
Well, I'm willing to tell them, Sophia.
Yeah, and a lot of it's coming out. The inclusion of Israel in this picture is not disappearing. It's actually appearing.
Well, what could be more blatant evidence than advancing Israelis? So on a rooftop across the river in New Jersey, we have five young people who are taking photographs, pictures of themselves posing with the towers going down and all this destruction in the background. They're arrested in a van, and when the arresting officer comes up, the driver says, "We're not your problem. The Palestinians we are your problem." They're held for 71 days until they're directed to be released by an assistant to the attorney general. They go back to Israel. They appear on, three of them appear on television and say the reason they were there was to document the destruction of the Twin Towers. What could be more blatant evidence? And the person who released them was Michael Chertoff, our current director of Homeland Security, who happens to be a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen.
Yes. We're going off for a 3-minute break. We'll be back. You're listening to Expansion on RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Jim Fetzer appears to be one of the few people who's willing to entertain some of the more expanded theories about the causality of 9/11 and those involved in it. Jim, are you still on our show?
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. I'm pleased to be here, and I think you're talking about the fragmentation of the movement could not be at a more appropriate time. I have a friend who's frequently posted on Blogger, who was serving as Kevin Barrett's campaign manager, who was simply stunned when Kevin Barrett was tossed off of Blogger because he is associated with me by virtue of our radio show where he hosts the dynamic duo Monday and Friday and I do Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It was probably a year ago or more that I was pitched off of Blogger simply because I was willing to discuss these things. I had a blog, how appropriate, where I had, I don't know, six or seven articles discussing what I take to be weaknesses in Steve Jones' thermite hypothesis. I was in the midst of a very interesting thread where a fellow was saying he'd been studying this very carefully, and he had decided that I was either completely right or completely wrong, and I was beginning to explain to him how on independent grounds he could determine whether I was right or Steve was right on a separate matter when I was tossed off. And people like Reprehensor who have come in and they're throwing everyone out who has any even remote association with me are displaying such a juvenile, childish, narrow-minded, obstructionistic attitude. In fact, it's made my friend is so disgusted with Blogger, but he's also done statistical studies and noticed that Blogger has lost like 95% of the traffic it used to have back in the old days when there was a area for discussing controversial issues. It's got narrower and narrower and narrower in its focus, more and more orthodox and authoritarian. And frankly, I don't know anyone who wouldn't be wasting their time by going there.
You know, many people tell me they no longer go there. They used to go there three times a day.
Yeah.
And they've stopped. I never go there. I was made a pariah by 9/11 bloggers.
Yeah.
And I began to sell your DVD in my store.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it did present some of the other views.
Yeah.
Which I believe always are welcome. Everybody is allowed to have a different viewpoint, but that nixed me.
Well, I can assert absolutely that I'm the only philosopher of science. I'm the only expert in scientific reasoning. I'm the only person who's taught logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning for 35 years who's involved in the entire movement. And if I don't understand the nature of science, then there's no one in the movement who understands the nature of science, and that includes Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, and others who would pass themselves off as scientists. Scientists are persons who practice the principles of science, Sophia, not ones who call themselves scientists who might be paid to be scientists. Steve Jones' conception of scientific method is grossly inadequate. He focuses on a single hypothesis. He says you form a hypothesis, you test it, you write up your findings, and you have it published in a peer-reviewed journal. Well, that's ridiculous as a characterization of scientific method, even though a lot of the public might naively swallow it. You have to look at comparative hypotheses. The stages of science are puzzlement. You got a phenomenon you want to understand. Speculation, you have to lay out the full range of alternative possible explanations. Adaptation, you have to assess each of the hypotheses in relation to the available evidence with regard to their explanatory power. In other words, what probability do they confer on the evidence if they were true? And finally, then, when there's sufficient evidence available, the hypothesis that provides the best explanation can be accepted in the tentative, infallible manner of science. Now, I explain all this on my website. If someone were to go to 911scholars.org and scroll down to the science of 9/11, they'll find me explaining this in a series of videos and interviews and discussions of Steve Jones' work. But people out there think Steve Jones is some kind of, well, not quite divine, but not quite far removed from it. I mean, he's not infallible. As I said at one conference, he's a Latter-day Saint. He's not a saint, meaning there's no reason to suppose that he's not going to make mistakes in his reasoning. And I pointed out a number. This very idea of this dust sample is frankly absurd.
I'm going to stop you for a minute.
Go.
The embracing of Steve Jones is because he's a physicist who came to, let's just call it, our rescue, the rescue of the movement. And I have no idea whether Steve Jones is serving somebody else's agenda or not. I can't comment on that in any way. I know that he created a tremendous wave of hope in the movement when he came in, and that was a good thing.
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm not finished. When the scholars were very popular, everybody was talking about 9/11 being a controlled demolition, and everybody basically agreed on that, that the government story was false, and here was an alternative explanation. We hadn't arrived at the more sophisticated or complicated or advanced methods yet.
Yeah.
So when that happened, there was division. Some people said, no unicorns, we're only going to talk about horses here.
Well, I mean, I don't fault Steve for his contributions. My God, I mean, I invited him to be my co-chair. When I founded Scholars, I brought Steve right in, and I supported his work, and I defended it. Absolutely. I spent a huge amount of time writing defenses of Steve Jones in the early days. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, the fact is that he is no longer, in my opinion, his current state is not good science. I'm not faulting him on any other ground. Steve is a wonderful human being. But he's not practicing, in my judgment, what is good science. He has a misconceived concept of scientific method. And his research, frankly, is not up to standard, in my opinion. And I lay out the reasons why in the section entitled The Science of 9/11. And you can, you know, people can read it and understand why I hold these views or not. But Sophia, I'm in a position to make these judgments.
Yes,
not all opinions are on a par here.
I understand, but he is entitled to continue his research.
Of course.
His research is scientific. Even though you feel it's narrow, it is. He's doing scientific research on thermite and thermate.
That's correct.
Yes.
And if that's all they were doing, that would be fine. But they lambast and preclude and condemn anyone who's doing other research. That's the problem. If Steve Jones is the patron saint of thermite and thermate, that's just fine. Steve Jones should be known for that. That's wonderful. I respect it, and that's perfect. If he could show us how he can use that hypothesis to explain the dustification of the Twin Towers, how these buildings were, you know, all this concrete and steel, 500,000 tons, was turned into very fine powder for each of the Twin Towers, how that was done using thermite and thermate, that would be fantastic. And how all the other damage was done to buildings 3, 4, 5, and 6, that would be fantastic. But he hasn't done that. He hasn't been able to explain the toasted cars. Sometimes he's made a gesture in that direction and says, oh, this is just what you expect from the thermite hypothesis. So far as I can see, that's just not true. But the point is, even if it were true, you have to compare the hypothesis with all the other possible explanations, or maybe a better one.
So you're saying that it's all right for him to be doing his research, but he shouldn't be excluding other people's work.
Absolutely.
There are other people who have, for instance, Judy Wood has thoughts or presentations about how the toasted cars have become toasted.
Right.
But the thing about this directed energy is that nobody really knows where and how it was.
That's the nature of science. You know, science is messy and it progresses in stages, and sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back. But we know these weapons are out there. They're starting to admit them all over the place. I have a recent piece talking about how they like to use laser weapons because of their plausible deniability. You can use them from a distance, and they're invisible, and therefore no one knows what actually was the cause. Well, that's what's going on here, that kind of thing. Look, we had a woman who sat through the whole conference, watched Judy's stuff very patiently. At the end, I invited members of the audience to come up and talk about it. And she said how until she watched Judy's presentation, she hadn't realized how obvious it was that, in her opinion, and this is a woman with a PhD in theoretical physics, masers have been involved. Well, if you don't look at the evidence, and if you don't have the right technical background, and if you don't understand the hypotheses, just as she understood the hypothesis of masers being involved, how in the world could you judge whether masers, lasers, or plasmoids were involved? Here's something else that these people they tend to ignore completely. You can buy thermite and thermate and RDX, these kinds of conventional explosives on eBay. If it was lasers, masers, plasmoids, these more exotic, this stuff directly implicates the military-industrial complex. Now, there's nothing that just as the CIA doesn't like its methods to be revealed when it engages, say, in something like video fakery, it doesn't like the military industrial complex doesn't like its methods of demolition to be revealed either. It's when you can expose the means that were used, means they're going to continue to use into the future, that they feel most at risk. And that's why I think these areas of research have been most heavily criticized, condemned, ostracized, because they're trying to suppress information about the means, the methods that they want to continue to use in the future, and that's all the more reason why you have an obligation to expose them so they won't be used in the future.
So that people know when and if they continue to be used, what is being used against them.
Exactly. And that's
why
you see the study of JFK, to which I devoted so much of my life, has been so important, because they use so many different techniques. Altering x-rays, faking photographs, substituting a brain, recreating a film, all this kind of stuff. that if you understand JFK, you realize that the techniques that are available to the government are almost endless, and you have to be wary of anything the government says because it can fake and fabricate evidence so effortlessly, just as it did in so many ways trying to convince us that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 or that Iraq was in cahoots with al-Qaeda. I mean, remember when Joe Wilson went down to Niger to investigate the claim that the administration had been pushing that Saddam was seeking yellowcake, he found it was based on flimsy, obvious forgeries. Well, they forge documents all the time. Nothing is simpler. Lee Oswald's Alec Heidel identity was forged by the CIA in an operation in Los Angeles, what was then known as the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store, where I know the guy who was responsible for preparing 15 sets of forged Secret Service credentials that were used in and around Dealey Plaza. I knew him, I met him, I talked with him, we discussed this at great length. This is what the CIA does. It excels in fabricating phony evidence. And the FBI covers up crimes. The FBI does this time and time and time again. The idea the FBI is out there trying to solve crimes and establish truth or enforce justice on behalf of the American people is complete and utter rubbish. The FBI is out there to cover up and conceal crimes and often perpetrate them on behalf of the administration.
And then we have the media. That's the third
one. And the media is complicit, too. I mean, that's what's stunning here. And that's why Ace is so right. You see, if there was this media duplicity, if there was video fakery and the media was promoting it, then they're complicit in the crime. It's like, what could be more stunning than that we have James Stanley for the BBC at 4:57 announcing that the Solomon Brothers building has collapsed, that being another name for Building 7, 23 minutes before the event would occur. I must say, how stupid are we? How much can we be played for saps that we can't perceive that if she's announcing it 23 minutes in advance and they had a script, they knew it was going to happen and they just got ahead of their script. And this is one of the most revealing incidents of collusion between the intelligence agencies, the government, the mass media in recent history. And who's going to dismiss it? The BBC has egg all over its face. It's so embarrassed it can't begin to say why this happened.
And you think that that was simply a mistake, an accident?
Oh, sure. They just got ahead of the script. They were supposed to announce it later.
Mm-hmm.
And, here you got her announcing it, and you can see the building over her left shoulder. It's really stunning. It's one of the most fascinating and instructive cases we have available to us. Not to mention Larry Silverstein, of course, talking to the fire commander and telling him there's been so much death and destruction, perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it. And that they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building come down. If the problem is there's been so much devastation, why you want to pull the building and cause more? I mean, no one has even raised that question about Larry Silverstein's rationale for telling them to pull it, to bring about even more devastation.
Well, it was his building. He was the owner and builder.
Yeah, but the point is, if the problem is devastation, that building was had
no,
very modest
was
damage.
Loss of life.
Yeah.
All right. We have a caller on the line. Let's take him. I don't see his name up here, but I'll be happy to take him.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hi,
put him through.
Jeff.
Hi, Sophia.
Hi.
You guys got a great conversation going on there. Just one thing that I'm thinking along these lines is that for the most part, this whole thing is like a controlled opposition from the get-go. There's such a minutia going on with the infighting that I think that's part of their game. They love the fact that we've got these fights going across the boards, whether it's on shows, whether it's on these blog sites, getting in the media, discussing these things back and forth that... It takes up so much time, apart from the actual research, that it creates a drama, a soap opera that's going on, and then we forget what's really going
on. What's important, what's central to understanding what happened on 9/11. You're absolutely right, Jeff. You're right on. And especially if they can find some little things. So this is the way the Republicans operate in politics, like this magnificent Obama speech last night. They would try to find something and then zoom in on that one little thing and focus on that as that were the whole case. When I had Ace Baker last on my show, he made a remark in passing about having received some hate mail from, and he mentioned the name of Andrew Johnson, who happens to be a close associate of Judy's. And Andrew just latched on that and denied he had any hate mail. And I said, and he wanted to come on the show and make this big, big, you know, a formal statement about it. I said, well, what is hate mail? You know, and he refused to define it. He says he's not going to get drawn into definitions. But if you can't define what hate mail is, how in the world can you know that you haven't sent it? I said, well, have you sent any stuff to Ace that is, you know, defensive or hypercritical or even hostile? And he wouldn't even answer the question, because that would all be borderline hate mail, which doesn't require specifically that you be denigrating somebody on the basis of racial or ethnic or whatever grounds. It's any form of really hostile, harassing kind of mail. So it may well be he actually sent it. But he was making a big deal out of it when the real issues had to do with video fakery, planes or no planes.
I want to just see, we only have 10 minutes left. We have a couple of commercial breaks in those 10 minutes. So, Jeff, is there more that you want to say about that before our break?
Well, for one thing, I think that it's pretty apparent that the whoever created all this crap, that they give the most credible information to the least credible person to get some of that information out. And then the opposite comes into effect with the rest of the information. I'm not sure, Jim, if you're like a complete no-planer, is like what some people like to call it, because there's a lot of name-calling going back and forth. I mean, they like to play out this whole false left-right paradigm where you're just in one camp or the other.
Yeah.
I know that the technology is out there for a lot of this stuff. I wouldn't call it video fakery. I'd call it maybe that days. I'm sure they probably enhanced a lot of the video that we saw.
Yeah. It's called it compositing, where they have live image and then they supplement it with.
Right. It's just, I know a couple people who actually saw some aircraft that day, whatever, no matter what it is.
We have our break coming. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us, Jeff.
All right.
You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm just finishing up this 2-hour show with Jim Fetzer. And we have our caller, Jeff, I think, still on the line. Are you there, Jeff?
I'm still here.
Did you want to conclude? We only have just a few minutes left.
Well, I just wanted to say that, there's a lot that we can research, and the stuff that Jim's bringing up in his background, some of the things that he's looked at, it's stuff that needs to be looked into, but at the same time, playing the political angle, I just think that when you're meeting somebody the first time and you're trying to get them into even believing something went wrong on 9/11 other than what the government said, we can't be talking about space beams and some of these other esoteric technologies, which I know exist, but you're just never going to be able to prove it, especially to somebody brand new. You're just trying to get into the information to see that something was not right about that day.
Hypotheses are tested based on their effects. Now, what you're talking about is actually finding weapons of this general class that you could use to reproduce the effects. And I think that it would be possible to do this through simulations and so forth, but it may be, you know, yet in the future. So I agree that you want to explain to the public, you know, and as an activist, how we know that the official account is wrong. And just point out that we're trying to figure out how it was done, but that's very messy and complex. So, you know, I've never denied that from the point of view of political activism, the people who aren't actually doing research here, that are trying to, you know, make converts in the public, that's, of course, the right way to go. So I agree with you, Jeff.
Right. There are black programs and technology that they've been working with for a long time, part of the Star Wars program, that we're not going to be able to figure out. I mean, we can't even at this point get somebody to test an airliner aircraft into a structure to see how these things play out with laws of physics. So we're definitely not going to be able to do that with exotic weaponry.
Many pilots, by the way, have tried to simulate what these hijackers are alleged to have done without success. So this is really quite interesting to using, you know, real simulators. Sophia, I'd like to add a couple words about Ace and this relationship with Judy before we conclude.
All right.
And I very much appreciate Jeff's call, because he made great general points, which is this. You know, the conflict between them emerged when I had Ace on a Wednesday and then Judy and Hutchison on a Thursday. They said it was odd to have Ace on Wednesday to talk about Hutchison before Hutchison had been on. So I said, offered them Wednesday, but they refused, and I'm sure it was because they wanted to come on after to counteract Ace's work. what they showed was that he was able to replicate the kinds of videos Hutchison has advanced as evidence of Hutchison's results. Now, Judy, and when Hutchison and Judy came on, I asked Hutchison a number of questions about his background and training, trying to figure out who the guy is and where he's come from. Judy responded to all of that extremely negatively and started, you know, posting criticisms of me for asking these questions about Hutchison when they were necessary questions to ask, and accusing Ace of faking videos when what he had done was construct videos deliberately to see if he could fake what Hutchison has done, which he was not concealing. He said this is what he did. I mean, if you're doing in the business of video fakery, you fake a video and claim it's authentic. What he did was just pose initially and then explain immediately that this was not authentic, that he'd done it to expose how easy it is to create these effects that Hutchison claims to be authentic. But Judy took that very, very badly, and I think this is part of the source of the contention between them.
All right, well, that's the end of our show. Thank you very much, Jim and Ace Baker and Jeff, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks, Sophia. These issues are important. I'm glad we're discussing them.